We have two cases set on our 10 o'clock docket. And before we get started, I wanted to introduce your panel today. To my left is visiting Judge Ruben Gonzalez, who's a district court judge here sitting at our invitation, and he was gracious enough to accept, so we're happy to have Judge Gonzalez. And to my right is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Lisa Kerr. The first case we have, I understand that the appellees are going to split. You're going to split your argument 9 and 6, so we'll have a brief reset of the clock after the 9 minutes on the appellees. And let's see, is everybody here for the second case yet? Good morning. All right. We haven't heard from. Okay. Well, we've got some time, so perhaps he will make it here. All right. Well, if the clerk will call the first case, we will get started.
The court will now call the State of Randall Cross et al. Deceased. And may it please the court, Mr. Caleb Moore to argue for the appellate, and Ms. Terry Jenkins Ryder, and Ms. Catherine Elder to argue for the appellate.
All right, Mr. Moore, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I wanted to use my time first to hit the jurisdictional issue of this court that's been raised in the motion to dismiss.
Oh, actually, I can save you some time because we feel like it's been adequately briefed, so you can just go straight to talking about substance if you would like to.
I would like to.
Okay.
Then I will jump to the next issue, which is the jurisdiction of the probate court at the time that it made its rulings. In this case, Ms. DeGaulle appeared in multiple capacities when she was negotiating with the other side. She was an individual, she was an employee and worker at the law firm and title company, an escrow officer. She was the spouse of the deceased, the sole beneficiary under the will, and the executrix in the will. As a normal person, she did not identify, I'm talking in this capacity or that capacity, when she's having discussions with her employees, who ultimately become the owners, two attorneys that had just started working for them at the time of her husband's death.
Mr. Moore, can I just ask for one clarification? Do you have any disagreement with the notion that after her husband died that Ms. DeGaulle had to sell the business?
Absolutely. Okay. There was a time period that was allowed. There was some disagreement and discussion initially in the corporate documents. Could we extend that time? Could we not? It was not explored in the record at the trial court level, but absolutely, she was a non-attorney. She could not long-term run the law firm. She had multiple options in how she could dispose of it, though, as the executrix being sell it to another attorney, become a direct operation, parse out the business and the clients, go work for someone else and take all of her clients with her. You'll see that in the record, most of the documents, when she conveyed this law firm to these two lawyers, identify the capacity in which she's signing, both individually and some of them with regard to some of the loan documents and the security agreements, and as the executrix of the estate. However, just like it's possible for liability to be created by one act in two capacities, for instance, a general contractor who makes a fraudulent statement can create liability individually for his own actions, but also create liability for his company in which the contract with the buyer, or the person having the thing built, exists. You can have, I think, capacity to act and bring suit in multiple capacities, which is the issue in this case. And it would be a crucial issue at the outset if there were other beneficiaries, other people that are going to benefit. But practicality here is that Ms. DeGaulle is everything, and any money that comes into the estate, any distribution, anything at all, is hers. And so while she retains counsel and they help her do this deal, the record demonstrates that most of the terms had been negotiated individually at meetings with Schultz and Keller beforehand. And they kind of came to the attorneys, who each hired separate attorneys, and presented a mostly done deal. Now, there is evidence at the last minute, during the final days, some of the length issues were kind of brought back into question and there was some back and forth. Ultimately, though, the deal gets done with no written employment agreement.
And is it your contention that they actually had come to a meeting of the mind before they signed the closing documents on March 28th of the material terms of her employment
Absolutely,
agreement?
Your Honor.
Okay, and what would you say that those material terms were that they showed some agreement on?
Schultz and Keller, in their deposition testimony, in particular Mr. Schultz, testified the compensation terms, which he framed and limited to compensation only, were agreed to. He disputes that Ms. DeGaulle, that there was a term, a length of years agreed to. You'll see on the morning of the transaction in the record.
Would that not be material, the length of the term?
That would absolutely be a material term. And he disputes that agreement, but there's substantial evidence that it was agreed to. The substantial evidence would be a morning, the email the morning of the closing where it says, will you take a five-year deal between the attorneys? My client testified that was presented to her. She called her attorney and said yes. The attorney for her, for the Ms. DeGaulle, calls the other attorney and says yes. The documents are completed.
Okay, and that's where I'm having some trouble. That email, I mean, I understand that your client's position is that she said yes, five years is great, but where do we have evidence in the record of what the other attorney responded or the client's?
His own testimony, the other attorney acknowledges that he believed an agreement on that had been reached but had not been formalized. There's disputed testimony on what Ms. DeGaulle was told. I don't think you're going to see anything in the record from her attorney, from Schultz and Keller's attorney, or Schultz and Keller saying we're not going to do an employment deal or it's still pending or material terms are left to be worked out before she signed.
But did she not contact her lawyer after the closing to basically say, hey, where are we on getting this done?
She did. There's emails to that effect. He responds that initially that I have everything I need and I'll start working on it tomorrow. Then as we go down the timeline, he says there's some other things that need to be discussed. He ultimately sends a draft over that contains numerous pages that the record demonstrates were never, had no material, no terms that were ever discussed by Ms. DeGaulle's testimony or Schultz and Keller's testimony or the two lawyers.
Okay.
And so.
But I think it was in September of 2013, though, wasn't it, where it seemed like for a time she was going to be really happy that they didn't have a written agreement?
There's some evidence that there's some testimony from that Ms. DeGaulle disputes vehemently.
Okay.
And directly in the record.
Okay.
As to what was going on in those meetings. In addition to the record, there's a text message and an email between Ms. DeGaulle and Mr. DeGaulle and Ms. Schultz regarding the agreement, at which time she hands a $50,000 check. According to Ms. DeGaulle, she confirms before handing that check, saying, are we good? I know the lawyers haven't got it done. We've got our five-year deal. Nothing's changed.
Was that text in your appendix? I noticed that there was a string of text messages.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, do you recall which, it would have been what, I guess before March 28th?
It would have been about 3 days after the closing.
3 days so after, okay.
Early June, maybe June 6th, if I remember correctly, right in early June. And that was one, the string of texts of one of the issues we had getting filed with the court so we could get them in an ability where you could read them. So there's that text, and then there's the continued performance by Ms. DeGaulle throughout the approximate year that she was hired, where she acts as a manager, she gets her salary, and she does everything she can to train these young lawyers on how to run a title company. Those are all acts that are consistent with someone who is believing they're participating as a silent partner, which is what she basically alleges was the agreement, and would not be consistent with somebody that needs to guard their resources because they could be fired at any time. So that evidence, at a minimum, creates a material fact dispute as to whether or not there was, in fact, an agreement. And I've cited the court to some cases where just because something was going to be documented more fully in the future is not dispositive in and of itself as to whether or not you can have an employment agreement or not.
So long as you have all, I guess, the terms that would typically be considered material in an agreement like that.
Yes, Your Honor. And those are the only the material terms that there's evidence on before the written documents were signed and in the immediate days after have been asserted as agreed to. They have done a good job of saying we never would have signed anything if there wasn't a vacation policy and discussing all these things. But they also admit not one time did they ever say to Ms. DeGaulle, we want these things. Their testimony is that it was a take-it-or-leave-it deal presented to them by Ms. DeGaulle, and they agreed. The only thing it shows they ever pushed back on in the days leading up to the sale is we don't want 10, we want 5. And there's some emails the day of and the 2 days before, and the testimony from everyone is that, for Ms. DeGaulle, is that she agreed to that and based on that agreement, signed those documents transferring a firm that was generating approximately $500,000 in take-home money for her and her husband for a promise to pay you in the future, and according to her, an appointment agreement.
I'm sorry, I misspoke a minute ago. I think I was talking about March, but it was obviously May. I see the texts now that
Thank you, Your Honor. You
attached.
So with regard to jumping back to the jurisdiction of the probate court, though, the record reflects that all of the assets had been distributed to Ms. DeGaulle individually. Individually, Ms. DeGaulle was going to be the person employed and doing work. There's no ancillary probate issue. And while they tried to bring a counterclaim that they ultimately dismissed just after the transfer, asserting claims against the estate, we've cited the court to some cases, In re Hanna in particular, Shell Cortez Pipeline, Schuld v. Dibrinsky, and Garza v. Rodriguez, where they talk about if the gravamen of the suit is not a probate issue, then there's no ancillary jurisdiction. And this case is clearly about Ms. DeGaulle being employed in her agreements with Schultz and Keller, either the fraud that resulted because they kept silent on their belief there was all these other terms, or the contracts themselves and the verbal agreements that are into and partially performed over the course of time.
But now, if I'm remembering right, the case was transferred to probate court, presumably against your client's wishes initially, but then wasn't it your client who then asked for the Dallas lawsuit against her attorneys to be transferred to probate court and consolidated?
We did ask for that after we objected to the transfer, and we tried to do our best to play the hand that we were dealt by the trial court, and if the trial court's going to determine that it has jurisdiction over these things and that the estate is the proper party, then we dealt with that in the best way that we could and asked that the cases be consolidated.
So if I understand correctly, the motion to transfer originally from the 48th was already granted at the time that you sought to have the Dallas malpractice suit moved to the probate court as well?
Absolutely. And it was hotly contested at that time. And the trial court there, Judge Furchel, denied our request, said, hey, they brought a claim against you.
Or Judge Evans? You mean Judge Evans?
No, Judge Evans did not make any ruling. This was Judge Furchel. The probate court made all the orders transferring the cases to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And heard all the arguments on that. We did not pursue any relief. My understanding of where I needed to pursue that was the probate court.
I'm sorry, that's my misunderstanding.
And so once we had that fight and we were overruled, what else can we do? And so we felt the cases should be consolidated. We were already considering consolidating in the district court potentially out of a same transactional type thing. Because initially, the district court case in Tarrant County was on track to come to a conclusion much more quickly than we would have a potential limitations issue on the suit against the attorneys. And we would know much more concretely if what damages would be based on relief. But once that case drug on, the limitations issue began to loom. And as of they filed a limitations argument, they don't even agree with our analysis of when it was going to run. But we believe we had some time. But once that time was going to run, we had no choice but to file the malpractice claim. So we argued for the consolidation, but also based on the trial court and the probate court, Judge Virchel's ruling, he's saying that this is an estate claim. So while we disagree, I don't think jurisdiction can be created just because somebody argues it right or wrong. It either is or it isn't. And so the issue of ownership of this claim is a dispositive issue with regard to jurisdiction, in my opinion. And we've briefed that issue and those cases that come down where they show that either the estate is ancillary or not really a main gravamen of the case. It's really a fraudulent inheritance. It's not really about the distribution or the collection of assets in the estate. Then it's not probate. It's not an ancillary case or a core jurisdiction case for the probate court. And those courts all overruled and sent back to district court or outside the probate court cases that have been transferred to the probate court based on this ancillary jurisdiction issue. The effect of the non-suit also when they non-suit their claims against the probate court, it's absolutely undisputed that everything that estate had gone to Ms. DeGaulle individually years before during this lawsuit. And so they non-suit their claim against the probate, against the estate. I believe that's what the basis of Judge Virchel's ruling was on. That was what the majority of the discussion at the hearing was on. They're suing the estate, limitations hasn't run, nobody closed the estate. Apparently in Tarrant County, there's always this hope of oil and gas resources down the road, and no one ever closes a probate estate formally. We've cited the court to a couple of Supreme Court cases where they say if there's been an independent administration, if everything's been filed and more than a year's passed, it's closed. It doesn't matter if you file that formal thing or not.
Aren't there some cases that go the other way? Because that's not like a rule or a statute, is it?
Absolutely, there's a dispute amongst the appellate courts on exactly how that applies. To me, the Supreme Court case, while it's old, is fairly dispositive, but I agree that appellate courts have often found little carve-outs to distinguish situations. But here, there's also Supreme Court cases that say if you're going to sue somebody regarding to estate property that's already been distributed, you should sue the person who has the asset.
Well, what about the section of the estates code that if I understand the appellee's position, would have kept the probate court from entering a formal order ending the probate proceeding because there was litigation pending?
That would only apply if it, in fact, should have been transferred there to begin with, if it still had an open case that could do anything, and it didn't. While people absolutely started filing, and we took absolutely several actions trying to avoid the transfer, we formalized and created a document, you know, saying what's already happened, that back in 2013, we transferred all the assets. Ms. DeGaulle individually owns everything. The estate claims nothing.
Okay.
We filed that.
Thank you, Mr. Morrissey. Your time's up. Thank you. All right, Mr. Dankesrider, am I saying that right?
Dankesrider,
close, I'm sorry.
Fine. May it please the court, first I want to address the jurisdictional issue with regard to the probate court. In order to do that, I want to highlight for the court some of the proceedings in the trial courts. From the outset, Ms. DeGaulle sued based upon acts that she took as the executrix of the estate. If we look at the transactions that were actually papered, she signed those documents in her capacity as the executrix of the estate. Her claim is then that she didn't individually receive an employment contract in connection with those transactions, even though all the writings don't refer to any other agreement or any other term that was necessary in order to fulfill those contracts. She never individually signed documents. She signed those documents in her capacity as the executor.
So the merger clause that's in the closing documents, would you say that would subsume anything that as executrix she might have said there was a side deal, but would that also keep her from raising an individual claim for an employment agreement?
Well, I believe it does, Your Honor, because what her position is that she wouldn't have signed the closing document selling the firm as executrix unless she had the employment agreement. If the employment agreement, her claim is not the employment agreement stood on its own. It was part of that transaction. That's what her argument is. So therefore the merger clause would assume that other employment agreement. She, with regard to the jurisdictional issues, the executrix is the one that filed in her fourth amended petition a statement in the district court, in the 48th district court, that she brought this suit in her capacity as the beneficiary and executrix of the estate. She made that claim in a fourth amended petition. And then she filed as the executrix of the estate claims against her former attorney, Dustin Sparks, and his law firm in Dallas County. As the executrix, she claimed malpractice there. And she brought that suit there, and then she later filed the motion to consolidate it into the probate court. She did that as the executrix of the estate. In the 48th District Court, that court ordered granted special exceptions that were filed by Keller, Sparks and Schultz and Keller with regard to the claims, and the court ordered that she distinctly set out in her pleading what claims she's making individually and what claims she's making on behalf of the estate. And in response to that, A few days later, less than a week later, she files a Fifth Amendment petition and she adds the estate into the style of the case. Then Schultz and Keller filed the counterclaims that were talked about. Then after all that happens, she files this notice of partial distribution, and then she files a request for an order closing the estate, or in the alternative, a request for partition. She files that in the probate court. So on its face, that document didn't close the estate. She was asking the probate court to take an affirmative step, and she never had a hearing and never got a ruling closing the estate. In connection with that, she made sworn statements as the executrix of the estate, and then she had the case on July 1st, whenever the case was transferred, she filed a seventh amended pleading, again, as the executrix of the estate, making claims on behalf of the estate, and those were the claims that were still pending at the time of the summary judgment. So whenever we look at what the estate's code says in section 32.05A, the probate court has the exclusive jurisdiction of all probate proceedings. And then if we look at section 31.002, a probate proceeding includes claims brought by or against a personal representative of the estate. Well, the personal representative of the estate, the executrix, had counterclaims filed against her, but was also affirmatively herself making claims on behalf of the estate. Those claims were pending at the time of the summary judgment. So in issue number one, Stiegel challenges the probate court's jurisdiction because she claims these Supreme Court cases that say the estate will close. But in those cases, all the debts were paid and all the gifts were delivered, everything was done, and there wasn't any pending litigation. If we look at the other cases, or all the cases with regard to this, the courts look to whether or not an administration was actually underway. So even if there's some kind of a presumption that's 1 year or 4 years or 16 years in the cases that we cite in our brief on page 25 and 26, they always look at this presumption can be overcome by what's actually happening in the estate. And all these actions taken not by the appellees, but taken by the appellant, the executrix of the estate, she took the actions that show by her own choice the administration of the estate was continuing.
At a certain point, counsel, the ancillary claims overtake the exclusive jurisdiction claims, and it's up to us as the appellate court to try to figure out where that line is. If I understand your argument correctly, in this case, what leans it to the probate court is the fact that actions were being taken on behalf of the estate that were pending at the time.
Is that correct.
The key that we need to look at?
I think that's the key.
What's the key case that we need to look at where we're making that decision?
Well, I don't know that there's the case. I think the court can simply look at the estate code, section 31.02.
What do you make of Mr. Moore's contention? And I do know this from experience, and at least anecdotal experience, that oftentimes estates are kept open for several numbers of years, maybe never even closed. And I'm just curious, at what point can we say this is over and done? This is essentially done in the probate court.
Well, I think that the way that it works in the probate code is that it can remain open forever, and then you have some kind of a presumption that after a period of time, if nothing is occurring, that it closes. And that's the Supreme Court case that has some age to it, but that he's talking about. And I don't disagree with that. I think if there was nothing occurring, that would be the presumption. But that presumption is overcome by activity done by the executrix. And I don't disagree with part of his argument is that essentially when you have an independent administration, the executrix can make these decisions as to when the estate closes or is open or is administered or all the assets are distributed. In this case, what did she do? The facts are she asserted claims on behalf of the estate. She continued to administer the estate by pursuing those claims. Had she responded to the special exceptions that were ordered in the district court by saying, I own all the claims, I individually own all the claims, been, it would have never been transferred to the probate court, because she would have said, I owned all the claims. But what she did was she decided that she owned some of the claims and the estate owned some of the claims, and she asserted those claims. That's what the court has to look to. She became a party to the case, and under the estate's code, she was a the estate was a party, and therefore the probate court had exclusive jurisdiction. In her second issue, she talks about under section 405.04, where you can formally close the estate, but this is where we get into the fact that that statute says you can only formally close the estate when there's no pending litigation. And the state, the case that they cite to is has been overturned because the statute changed and added that language in 1995. I don't have much time left, so I'll talk a little bit about the breach of contract case. I just want to point out the one material term that everybody agrees was undisputed. It's undisputed. Mrs. Segal says in her brief on page 56, they write that the employment agreement would be in writing. This is not disputed. That's the one material term that's undisputed, that it was going to be in writing. And the statute of frauds would require that it be in writing. And here it wasn't ever put in writing, and as such, they don't have a contract claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dunkus Ryder. Ms. Elrich.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Catherine Elrich, and I represent Appalese, Gary Porter and Donovan PC, and Dustin Sparks, and I'll collectively refer to these Appalese as the GPD lawyers. These are the lawyers who represented Priscilla Stegall individually and as an executor of Randy's estate in the sale of the Stegall Law Firm. We adopt the arguments presented by our co-appalees, the Schultz and Keller lawyers, regarding the probate court's jurisdiction, and want to briefly just highlight two reasons why the summary judgment should stand as to our clients. As to the GPD lawyers, the judgment should stand, one, for the reason that the appeal is untimely. There's no appellate jurisdiction here because the notice of appeal was filed after the due date. And two, the limitations expired on Stegall's claims well before she filed suit against the GPD.
Yeah, let me ask you about the accrual of the malpractice claims, because I understand that you and the appellant disagree entirely on when the claim would have accrued, but what, as a practical matter, if we get to June 1st of 2013 and Ms. Stegall, or I keep hearing it pronounced different ways, the appellant, what would she have been able to sue for at that point in the absence of, I mean, she didn't have a crystal ball and know that her employment would be terminated a year later or anything like that. So what would have been her cause of action and her damages at that point?
Yes, Your Honor, that is an important question. That the moment she transferred the firm to the S&K lawyers without having an employment agreement, she had suffered a risk of harm. And that is the test for the accrual under the legal injury rule. And what is that legally protected interest? Well, her own affidavit explains what harm existed at that point. Management decisions were being made without her, and that was a term that she had hoped to achieve in the employment agreement, that she would have some say-so in the management of the firm. She had testified in her affidavit that she had lost her leverage in the sale of the firm. And also, her employment was at risk of being terminated. She did not have the security of an employment agreement to keep her from being fired at will by the Schultz and Keller lawyers. So while she may not have had the full effect of her damages, may not have occurred at that point, at that very moment when she sold the firm without an employment agreement, because she was still employed but at will, that's not the test under Texas law. The test is, what is the risk of harm? It's at that moment, what type of risk it may, it does not have to be fully and finally established damages at that point. And I think that is where appellants misunderstand the law on the accrual date.
Is that the KPMG case that you're primarily thinking of there?
Yes, Your Honor. It's KPMG as well as Idell. And it's also in Atkins as well. I know they rely on the Atkins case, the IRS deficiency case, but they're reading Atkins too broadly. All of these cases are in line that say that there's no requirement to have an inevitable and finally established harm. Atkins doesn't even require that. It's just this, at that point, a suffering of a risk of harm to her legal interests. And Zidell, Atkins, the Murphy case, all of those cases that we've cited in our brief explain that. And it's really important when you're looking at the accrual day, what are the claimed injuries? Well, Sagal has two claimed injuries here with respect to her legal malpractice claim. She alleges a loss of value to the firm, that the GPD lawyers were negligent in handling negotiations for the sale of the firm because it was sold without an employment agreement, and a loss of value of the employment agreement, which is her individual claim. That closing date was on May 28th. That's the date of the legal injury. She filed her petition on March 14th in her own name, and then she waited even longer on July 27th to amend and file as the executor of Brandy's estate. These dates, the filing in March and then the later filing in July, were too late based on the accrual date as well as the discovery rule. I know we're running out of time. We don't have a whole lot of time to discuss the discovery rule, but even if you were to give her every single benefit of the doubt, in her affidavit deposition testimony, she says at the September 9th meeting with the lawyers, with Dustin Sparks, that she knew, she was well aware she did not have an employment agreement, well aware decisions were being made about the management of the firm at that point. She knew she had lost her leverage, and she knew at that meeting that she could be fired at that point. So whether we're looking at the accrual date or we're looking at the discovery rule, either way, statute of limitations bars the claims. If there are no further questions for me from the court, we just respectfully request that this court affirm the probate court's judgment.
Questions?
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Moore?
May it please the court. With regard to a couple key things to look at, when this case was initially filed, it was filed in the individual capacity. Ms. Segal filed individually. Only once the special exception started getting set for hearing, we had to go down there, and I'm looking at Judge Evans, and he's asking what claims are capacity of executrix, what are individual, and we do the research, and I'm saying, well, there's a split in the case law, Judge. I can't just positively tell you and make a legal conclusion that I can rely on that it's only individually or only the executrix, because there's arguments for both sides. So as a prudent, I think, trial attorney, we amend, and in the alternative, assert the capacity of executrix. Say, to the extent, if you look at the actual wording of the pleadings, to the extent a claim is not individually owned, then as executrix we pursue the claim. Because the reality of the lawsuit is that it doesn't matter where the money's going to go. It's all going to end up with Ms. DeGaulle. So,
well, but reality is not exactly the probate court, the probate code sometimes. What do you make of opposing counsel's argument that because the estate brought affirmative claims and these claims were filed both in the name of the estate, at the same time we had motions that you were filing on behalf of your client and seeking affirmative relief in the probate court, that based on the probate code, these claims had to be in the probate court. How do you respond to that argument?
I respond with, first of all, we didn't seek any affirmative relief in the probate court. We filed notices there to the world saying the claims have been distributed already long ago to Ms. DeGaulle in an effort to try to clarify that issue. So as a matter of law, though, that had already happened. So it was essentially a notice of distribution. And if you read the notice of distribution, it says back in 2013.
But was the estate not asserting any causes of action once the Dallas claims got transferred in?
The estate didn't. Yes, after the probate court says, I'm asserting jurisdiction, this looks like a probate matter, estate claims were asserted directly to deal with that issue. And my contention would be, just because somebody asserts in a capacity, they can be wrong. You cannot create capacity that doesn't exist. And I think as the case is talking about the distribution of the assets that we've cited the court to, that is the dispositive issue. If all the assets have been distributed to Ms. DeGaulle individually, including the claims, she owns. And while there's arguments and some split in the Court of Appeals on how an estate is closed, even if the estate is open.
But did you bring the case on behalf of the estate? Didn't you bring claims on behalf of the estate?
Not until after, in the alternative, after we had the special exceptions hearing. Initially, individually only.
Did you respond to the special exceptions and say all these claims belong to Ms. Stegall?
We did. We argued that, and but again, I cannot dispute that there's, you know, she signed in certain capacities. Our contention is, yes, we signed documents, and back in 2013, there's this estate issue. And then time goes by. Every single thing in that, all the money from the estate, all the claims, every asset, everything that the estate could have had was transferred to Ms. Stegall, and she owns it individually. But can I make that legal conclusion and know with 100% certainty that if we go and win as an individual, that a court of appeals might not say, you had it wrong, counselor? And so we asserted in the alternative. And
I some might argue that's trying to have it both ways, counsel.
Absolutely, we're trying to have it both ways, and I think the law allows us to assert claims in the alternative and have it both ways until a court overrules us. And that's why we brought the declaratory judgment action and were denied, and the court ultimately ruled, the probate court said it was moot because he was already dismissing all the other claims. But we sought a declaration as to the ownership of the claims and had moved for that relief, and we never got a ruling on it. And so rather than just say, I know what it is, I'm going to have a judge overrule me and make a determination or make a legal determination that I can rely on and preserve error to my client down the road. And that's what we attempted to do.
But until that is or isn't done, isn't there at least a pretty colorable argument that the probate court has jurisdiction over that determination?
No, because the issues in dispute involve the employment agreement and compensation to Ms. Stegall and what she was going to receive. And she operated in two capacities initially. As an executrix, she negotiated an employment agreement for herself individually. Or she individually negotiated it and used her power as executrix to transfer the law firm to them in exchange for the benefits she was going to individually receive. The fraud occurred in their meetings with them, specifically with her, in her individual capacity. So all of those claims, all of the losses, involve her individual losses. With regard to the malpractice, just really quick, the court's question about what could she have sued for, there was nothing she could have sued for until she was fired, because she was receiving all of the economic benefit. She might have been disgruntled or unhappy. Those are not causes of action. And unlike the cases where there was a real estate deal and the notice of the depth of the injury was not known until later, the court said, yeah, but when you bought the property for the wrong value, you suffered an injury you could have sued. There's no partial damage here that kicked off until she was terminated.
Okay. Thank you. Your time is up. Unless anybody has any more questions. All right. Your case is submitted. Thank you very much. The argument was helpful. And do y'all need a break or want to go straight through? Okay. We'll give you